This podcast was made possible by a sponsorship from AveXis, a clinical stage gene therapy company. The following content was not developed by AveXis.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 36. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining us today is Mike Blakey from Gainesville, Florida. Mike is a part-time CPA and attorney, and he has SMA type 3. Mike and I met a couple years ago at the 2017 Cure SMA conference in Orlando, Florida, and we're excited to have him on today. So, Mike, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Kevin.
Absolutely. This will be a great discussion. So, before we get started, if you could please listen to a brief word from our sponsors.
Are you interested in understanding gene therapy? ExploreGeneTherapy.com has helpful information about gene therapy, including its history and how it is being investigated for the treatment of genetic diseases. Visit www.exploreGeneTherapy.com.
All right. Well, Mike, let's start just by talking about your background and growing up with SMA. What was it like for you as a kid growing up with a disability?
Sure, Kevin. I was born in the late 60s, so I'm on the older edge of the spectrum of individuals I think that have been on your SMA News Today podcast. My diagnosis, or my parents started noticing a difference between myself and my peers when I was around three years old. I crawled at a normal age, and I was able to stand and walk around age one. It was when I was around 3 years old and I was having difficulty going from squatting position to standing, and I wasn't able to run or jump like normal kids at that time. We were living in married housing in Southern Illinois University. My father had returned from Vietnam, and so there were a lot of other children around, and so I think my parents had a pretty good basis for comparison. I was the oldest of three siblings, and so their experience about normal milestones and stuff was, with me, limited. And so when I was about three, I remember going to see a lot of doctors and specialists, and it was first around it was in the St. Louis area that I saw many specialists. At first, they thought I might have a mild form of polio. And at some point, when I was around four or five, we moved to Michigan. And that is where I grew up, in Muskegon, Michigan, on the western side of the state of Michigan, along the beautiful sand dunes. And at the University of Michigan Hospital, just before my fifth birthday, I was diagnosed with Kugelberg-Wielander disease, which I believe is now titled or called spinal muscular atrophy type 3. And that diagnosis initially shocked and saddened my family. The extent of what we were told and knew about the diagnosis at that point in the early 70s was basically a pamphlet put out maybe by the MDA clinic. You know, the diagnosis, prognosis and stuff was grim, or not necessarily the most hopeful diagnosis. But anyway, I came from a family where education was always stressed to maximize the abilities that you had. My grandmother and my mother were both teachers. My grandfather was a small businessman, and I remember he owned a coal company, and I remember he had hired a one-armed individual to shovel coal and deliver coal. I remember he was one of the first businessmen to hire women as truck drivers. And so I think I came from a progressive family when it came to disabilities, without realizing it at the time, that you played the hand you were dealt with. And I don't ever remember, you know, I was always disabled, so I never really gave it a second thought. It was just part of who I was. And growing up as a kid, I was comfortable with being disabled, but I didn't want to be known for being disabled. I wanted to be known as Mike, the good-looking, funny guy, or Mike, the smart guy, or the one that always has a good joke, or the Mike with the cool car, which has still never happened. But I, you know, those are the things that shot for that I growing up disabled. I was comfortable being disabled, but I didn't want to be known only for being disabled.
Right.
So I went to I don't know where you want me to go with this, Kevin, but so then I grew up in Muskegon, Michigan, and I went to public schools with no special accommodations.
That's what I was going to ask, is what, you know, was there anything there, or what was it like kind of navigating the public school system? Because, you know, you and I were talking right before this before we started recording about the episode I did a couple months ago with Kelly Miller, and she was talking about her story there, having, you know, no resources or anything, having to fend for herself. Was that, what were the challenges of that?
So I don't remember when I went to go to public schools. I do know that there was a special school for disabled that was part of the school system. I'm sure that when I went for introduction to the schools, that was something that was discussed as a possibility. I know I was assessed and placed and told I was a normal progress or above normal, and was just placed in normal kindergarten and first grade. I think I was fortunate when I look back at it, and that all my schools from elementary to middle school to high school were all one level. You know, and maybe the distance between classes and stuff wasn't as far as it could have been at a lot of schools. But I don't remember that being ever, you know, discussed. What I had the most problems with was, as far as the public was getting to and from school.
Okay.
School bus steps were always really difficult for me. And, you know, I think if I had, this was in the era before lightweight manual wheelchairs and before power wheelchairs, those type of things were never discussed or brought up with me. It was either you went to school, and Kevin, I walked, but I struggled to walk. I fell down frequently in the ice and snow. I struggled to get back up when I fell, but I didn't know any different. And I also came from, I think, a family where if a child falls down today, I think a lot of parents rush to help them back up. And I don't know what you would call it, hard love or learning how to get by on yourself, how to be independent. But when I fell down, my parents didn't rush to pick me up. There wasn't somebody there. They, I think, installed in me a sense of independence and try to figure out how to stand back up on your own. And, you know, I don't know if it's right or wrong. It's just how it was. And that type of mentality, I think, helped me throughout my life. Things weren't always going to be the easiest for me, but I figured out ways to do things before the ADA came into existence and before there were services out there and public accommodations for disabled. You know, I just struggled and did the best I could, and dealt with the falling down and the getting back up and stuff. Nowadays, I think probably I would have probably been placed in one of those manual wheelchairs that helps you to self-propel yourself. Those look really
right.
Cool. And, I think I probably would have been put in a wheelchair at maybe third or fourth grade. And not that there's anything wrong or right about either way. It's just I think because I was forced to walk in order to have a normal education, I think I maximized all and every ability that I had growing up with SMA. And anyway, that I hope that answered that question.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and building off that note too about independence and, You know, you and I have had many conversations about careers in college, but I wanted to dive deeper into that. So first off, can you talk about the transition to college and what that was like for you?
Sure. So like I said, I came from a family where education was always stressed. I don't remember ever being, it was always assumed I was going to go to college and that my siblings were going to go to college. All my cousins were going to go to college. It was more like, where are you going to go to college? Not, are you going to go to college? And so as I got older, when I reached high school, I realized that I didn't want to, it was going to be more difficult for me to live in the ice and snow. And so I started looking at schools between my 10th and 11th grade in high school. I started looking at colleges in the South. I looked at anything that was south of Tennessee. So I looked at schools in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and then on over to Texas and California. And then when I was a junior in high school, my father and I took a long father-son drive across the country, and we visited a lot of schools. And I had a kind of a rough idea that I wanted to go into maybe something in business, but I wasn't sure. And so when I went to look at schools, I was looking at whether the buildings were close together and how close were the dorms to the where the classes were going to be. And were there a lot of hills around? So I grew up in Michigan, and most of my family had gone to the University of Michigan. And I went to a summer camp there when I was in high school, and I found the University of Michigan, at least where I had stayed and where I was participating in camp, I found it difficult to get around, more difficult than I had anticipated. When I visited some of the schools in the South, I had a great first impression when I visited the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. For whatever reason, all the business buildings were all right together, and they were nearby dorms. And I knew nobody in the state of Florida when I went to college, but I just decided that I wanted to try to take that risk and to go off and do my thing. I decided that if I was going to work after going to college, that I probably stood a lot better chance of getting a job in the region that I went to school. And so it didn't make a lot of sense for me to go to school in Michigan and stay close to my family and support network if I was going to ultimately be looking at working in Florida or Texas or California or somewhere where it's easier to get around when you're disabled or when you're using a wheelchair.
Sure.
So ultimately, I think that's a long answer to, I went and looked at probably 20 universities, and they weren't necessarily based completely on academics. They were based on what I call logistics. Did they have the academics I'm looking for? But then also, was I going to be able to make a good faith effort at being able to complete the college on my own without a lot of outside physical assistance?
Sure, sure. Well, and building off of that, so like, you're type 3. What kind of needs did you have at that time, you know, that you had needed caregivers for and that kind of thing?
I didn't need, okay. You know, when I look back at it, I depended on a lot of friends to do a lot of things.
Okay.
So, like, you know, so when I went to college in the late 80s, again, this is before the ADA, there was an office at the University of Florida that would maybe help with some accommodations. So they put me in a first floor dorm. That was the only accommodation, I believe, that was there. And if there was a class that wasn't on a first floor and there wasn't an elevator in the building, they would consider moving the class, if I gave them enough advance notice, to a first floor level. But those were the only accommodations at the public university at that time. So there were some things when I went away to college that I didn't anticipate doing. I didn't realize like how hard laundry was going to be for me. There were certain things like that, carrying books and just, and so I quickly learned to ask for help from either my roommates or people in classes and stuff. And, you know, that's, it's been my approach, and it's been my, what I found out is, you know, most people are willing to help if you ask them something reasonable and they feel good helping you out. But so I'm not certain that I would recommend going off without any support to, off to college. But at the time, that was the only thing I knew to do.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, I mean, you do what works for you. I was just curious kind of like what kind of independence you had and what system you had there. But okay, so, you know, you did your undergrad there. And then you went to law school after that. Could you talk a little bit about that and just kind of the trajectory of your law career?
Sure. So after I graduated with my undergrad degree in accounting, I started working for a company here in Gainesville. And I went to I got my master's in accounting also. At the time, I thought I was going to be a certified public accountant. And I guess, Kevin, I should also say, you know, when I was looking at majors, I was also looking at something that I would be able to do to provide for myself, to maintain independence, and something that I would be able to do while in a wheelchair, because I could see that was where I was progressing. So while I was in college, those first 4 years, I gained some weight. I'm 5'11". I weighed probably about 140, and you know, things started getting harder for me, getting up from a seated position to a standing position. Steps, which had always been difficult for me, became even more difficult. And so I want to say that I also kind of fell into the accounting major because I looked at that as maybe a job that didn't require a lot of physical activity. And so when I graduated, I got a job as an accountant working as a controller for a mid-sized company here in Gainesville. And that was fine and good. But I found out after a couple of years that I didn't like doing the same thing every day and going to the same office. And so I got my master's in accounting and passed a CPA exam. And then I had always had in the back of my mind that maybe law school would be something I would be interested in. I felt after working for several years as an accountant that I wanted to get out of the office and getting into the courtroom, having every day be something different just was something that really intrigued me. And so once again, I looked at a lot of schools for going to law school. I had decided by the mid 90s that law school, I wanted to do it while I was still physically able to do it. When I look back at it in retrospect, I wish I had made the transition to using a wheelchair before law school. I think that would have been a lot better a time to make the transition. As it was, I made the transition after law school and before beginning work. And anyway, that would be one, there's never like a perfect time, but when sure. You look back at your life and you go, well, it would have been a lot easier to make that transition at that point, as opposed to when I was out trying to get my first legal job and you're trying to figure out, well, you know, how do I get into this courthouse and how do I do this? All on top of learning how to get around in a wheelchair for the first time. So that was a little, my first years of being in the wheelchair and as a practicing attorney were a little overwhelming.
I bet. Yeah.
So, did you ever use that? I looked at a lot of schools for law school. I ended up going back to the University of Florida for law school.
Gotcha.
You know, that's one of those things too, where I looked at moving to New Orleans and going to Tulane or Emory and moving to Atlanta. And I visited all those cities and looked at where I could envision myself living for the next 20 or 30 years, which is where we're at now as I talk to you. So again, where you maybe went to graduate school is a, where you might end up in that vicinity, you know, living and working. That's one of the main things I think that if I had to give a small piece of advice to individuals considering where they're going to go to school, maybe college is going to be the easy part of your career. It's the whole working and living in those years that come after college that you need to be thinking about, even though it's seems so far out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and just a quick side note, you know, you talked about the transition to the wheelchair. Had you had a wheelchair as a backup prior to that, or were you just fully ambulatory?
I was fully ambulatory, but when I look back at it, you know, I was losing abilities.
Sure,
and
sure.
I was depending on, so I look back at pictures and I was depending on girlfriends. I see myself leaning on girlfriends as we're walking and things like that, that I didn't really, I took for granted that I didn't realize I was doing.
Sure.
And I'm sure some of the, when I made the transition to a wheelchair, there was a lot of, there's a stigma that goes along with the wheelchair, but there was a lot of freedom that things I didn't worry about anymore. So like going grocery shopping, I didn't worry about how much stuff I got and whether I was going to fall down carrying the bags out to the car. And there was a lot of things that I no longer, you know, the barriers weren't there. You think of barriers when you're in a wheelchair, and there are certain barriers, but there was also certain freedoms that I gained by making the transition to a wheelchair. I had also like to say, you know, one of my passions, Kevin, has always been watching amateur athletics.
Okay.
So I would be amiss if I didn't mention that. So I grew up going to University of Michigan football games with my family. I wanted to go to a school that had a strong sports program because I enjoy, even though it's superficial and all that stuff, I really enjoy the camaraderie and cheering certain amateur athletic events. And football is one of those. There was no handicap or wheelchair seating at the University of Florida for students whenever I came here. My friends and I got a lot of piggyback rides up and down the stands of the swamp at the University of Florida. And, you know, it's just one of those things with how I dealt with things. I remember going the first or second time when I was a freshman in the dorms with my roommates at the time, and they realized how hard it was going to be for me to climb up the amount of stairs that we had to go to where we were sitting. And the next thing I know, one of them was hoisting me on their back. And, you know, for the next 4 years, and I think that there was a, you know, we always just went to games together, and that was just how it was.
Sure, sure. Oh, yeah, no, it's great, things like that that bring, you know, that community together. And yeah, that's really cool. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, some of your passions outside of work. Well, and Mike, on that note, too, also talking about transitions and, you know, your career. So in 2013, you, and this is something you talked to me about as well, you eventually decided to scale back a little and focus more on your health. So can you talk about what that transition has been like and, you know, just some of the ups and downs?
Yeah, when I, so I practiced corporate and construction law in Gainesville for approximately 13 years full time. And I made partner in the latter years, but I was also not maintaining a very healthy lifestyle. I gained a bunch of weight. I was going to the bar and drinking every day after work. And I was experiencing a series of physical mishaps. I fell down getting into bed. And one time it ended up in a broken leg. Another time after one of my biggest legal victories, I was going down these brick cobblestoned streets in the town where I had just had my my trial and victory, and my foot bounced off the foot peg. Oof. And I ended up running over my foot and breaking my ankle and leg. And so I was not, while I was having great, some good success career-wise, I was on a downward spiral as far as my health went. And I didn't have a very good balance. I'm an all or nothing kind of guy, and I'm working 60 or 70 hours and burning the candle at both ends. And so in 2013, after breaking both legs and my jaw in a series of like 3 or 4 years, I decided I needed to scale back my work activities and take better care of myself, or else, frankly, I wouldn't be here today, I don't think. And so since 2013, I've scaled back my activities to working part-time, and I've started supplementing that with, I swim every day, I try to eat healthy, I quit drinking alcohol, I've lost a bunch of weight, and which has added a little bit more to my mobility. Frankly, I feel better right now today than I did 20 years ago. It's amazing. So I guess you can succeed in everything you want to do and set your mind to career-wise, but there also needs to be a balance with taking care of your physical needs, and especially those of us with SMA. It's very easy to get into a lifestyle that's perhaps not beneficial for your condition.
Absolutely. Well, and also, and I did want to, on that note, talk a little bit about Spinraza and Zolgensma too, but before, just a quick side note too, you know, in regards to your care situation, you and I have a similar setup in that we've each had the same primary caregiver for several years. I was just curious, you know, about that relationship and how you and your caregiver met.
Thank you for bringing that up, Kevin. So in 2013, reached out and ran an ad in the paper, actually, that said I needed an aide that was a strong individual that could pick up I think I put a 160-pound man and had a clean driving record. I should have done this. You know, this is another thing, like I said, I wished I had maybe made the transition to using a power wheelchair earlier. I should have gotten help earlier. But there is no, as far as I'm aware, there is no roadmap for those of us with SMA. We can only learn maybe from others. And so I wished I had reached out and gotten some sort of aid, somebody to help me with daily activities earlier, because I think I would have prevented some of those physical problems that I had. You know, it's the whole, if I let somebody help me, you know, I felt like it was a slippery slope, and that soon I would be depending on people for everything, and I was going to lose my independence, and a bunch of things that didn't happen. It's only been a good thing. So I ran an ad, and I've been told by many people that my arrangement with my caregiver is similar to the movie The Upside, which I have not seen.
I wrote a column about that earlier this year. Yeah.
Yes. So I think my aide, who's now been my aide for 7 years, and is, I call, one of my best friends also now, I lucked out with him. I interviewed a lot of people, but I went with somebody that didn't have maybe much experience with caregiving, but was somebody I could see myself being able to go on road trips with, which was what I needed, somebody to be able to drive me. And just, you know, somebody that I could see spending time with that could do also the physical things. And it's worked out great. I feel fortunate, and I hope I'm able to, 7 years from now, be saying the exact same thing.
Sure. Yeah, no, and I'm glad you said that about, you know, and I've actually interviewed my caregiver on the podcast before. Listeners can go back and listen to that episode. But yeah, that was big thing for me as well, is not just, okay, are they qualified, but also, you know, can you see yourself spending time with this person every day and have it, because it's a very intimate relationship, and you want to make sure that it's a person you can not only depend on, but yeah, that you can be friends with as well. So that's really cool that you found that. But
so I wanted to just add on to that, Kevin. So I use my assistant 4 hours a day, and now they he comes in the morning, and well, I'm still able to get in and out of bed on my own. I don't feel like I can do it really very safely. And so he comes in the morning and helps me with my morning activities, and we go swimming every morning. And then so we spend about 3 hours in the mornings, and then he comes back and is here for about 45 minutes in the evening to help me into bed. But the rest of the 20 hours and the 24 hour period, you know, I'm still on my own.
Sure.
And remain independent. And that has been a good balance for me now for the past a little over 6 years.
That's great. And yeah, I'm glad you said that. And yeah, because I'm always fascinated to hear each person's kind of individual setup and how much care you need, how much you can do independently. So that's great. Well, Mike, wrapping up here, I did want to talk a little bit about, you know, Spinraza and Zolgensma, in talking about, you know, your health and just where the SMA community is today. So obviously it's a pretty monumental time with the recent FDA approval of AveXis's gene therapy drug Zolgensma. We now have two treatments for SMA. So can you just talk about what this means to you and also your experiences with Spinraza?
Kevin, I think that this is just an exceptionally exciting time in the SMA community. When I look back at my life and going from the diagnosis in 1974, I never mentioned in this podcast, Kevin, but I did get genetic testing when I was close to 30 years old. That confirmed that original diagnosis back in 1974. And actually that was a little, it put some relief just knowing that I had a confirmed diagnosis at that time. But I just feel like this is such an exciting time in my lifetime. I've seen us discover the gene that was causing SMA in the 90s to now a little over 20 years later, we have two treatments available. I was always optimistic that there would be treatments available in my lifetime. I would say I was impatient, but it is certainly an exciting and exuberant time in the SMA community. As far as me personally, I go in for my next Spinraza maintenance dose. Next month, that will be my fifth maintenance dose. I believe I've had nine of Spinraza doses now. Because I would swam every day in the pool, I have noticed subtle beneficial changes to my body since I've undergone the Spinraza dosing. And so I just can't, I'm excited about what the future holds and the treatments that I'm excited for individuals that are going to benefit, that don't even know what the community went through and the enormous sacrifice that a number of individuals who are no longer with us made to the SMA community to get us to where we are today.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and it, I mean, same kind of thing. I mean, from my perspective, it's amazing how far we've come just in my lifetime. But, you know, I mean, for years, it's even crazier just because you didn't even have the official diagnosis of SMA when you were younger. So it's just crazy that we live in that world today. So, well, Mike, I want to really thank you for coming on today and for sharing your story. Before we close out, is there anything else you would like to say either about your life or just any advice you have for other people with SMA out there?
I guess the one thing I'd like to say, Kevin, is to the SMA, to anyone who's affected by SMA is don't be afraid of failure. Don't be afraid to try things. You should determine your limitations and not a medical professional. And I do think it's important to be pragmatic and listen to what medical professionals may offer you, but that you should set your own limitations.
Absolutely. That's great advice. Well, again, Mike, just thank you so much for coming on today. And this was a pleasure. So
thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
Absolutely. And for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums page and follow our main website for the latest SMA news. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
The information in our flash briefings and podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. All of our podcast and flash briefings can be found on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. You can also find our podcast and flash briefings on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. And be sure to follow us on our Instagram and Facebook page as well. For SMA News Today, I'm Michael Morale, Multichannel Content Director.